All right, here we go with another episode of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Be glad that you're not, because there's only one of me, and that is more than enough, I think, for just about everybody. Let's get to it. This is a bit of an unplanned Wednesday rant. Is full disclosure always being of the utmost importance to me. I was actually supposed to be doing a show with another podcaster, and it was really built around all the Earth Matters work that I've done for a very long time with Bill Curtis. And tying through with technology, is especially with wireless technology, is never a good thing. So I can remember back in the day when I first started in radio, and there was a thing called a Gettner, and a Gettner box or a Gettner unit is something you would tie into your board, and you would be able to run phone calls through the Gettner and hear them on air and all that kind of stuff. And it's pretty standard equipment. But the studio that I started in, they didn't have a Gettner. They didn't have a hell of a lot. But they gave me a chance to be on there, and that was how it really all started. And I approached them one day, and I said, listen, I'm having, you know, this time I'd probably been on the air about 4 or 5 months, and I'm starting to have more and more guests, and all you have is a telephone in there. And if we get this Gettner, I can tie the phone in and people can hear it a lot better. And at that time, the Gettner probably cost $200. And they're like, well, that's not in our budget. Now, on one hand, I get it. I don't even know if they really sounded that way, but it was effective, right? It's not in our budget. That's kind of the suit sound that way. $200. Now, keep in mind, I wasn't even earning any money in radio when I started in 97 doing this. So I wasn't going to pay for it. I'd only been on the air, like I said, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. No idea that I'd be doing this 23 years later. So I could see why they wouldn't invest in that. It was the only show they had that was of a talk show nature. So what I had to do instead of not having the Gettner is pick up the receiver on a landline tabletop telephone. Remember those? They weigh about 9.5 pounds. You used to order them from Ma Bell. I think they had white, yellow, and black, you know, various colors. And there was this big landline sitting in there. So I'd have to pick up the receiver and hold the receiver to the microphone and listen in my ear on the ear pad on the receiver, and then hold the bottom part of the receiver where you could hear somebody speaking right next to the microphone. So hopefully the microphone picked up their answer. So here's what I would do. I would ask them a question, and then I'd flip it down, and I would hold the bottom of the phone right on top of the microphone so they could answer. Now, some of those shows were taped. I don't know where those tapes are at. They're probably in the National Archives of Radio, something or another, or in a landfill somewhere. Sometimes it's the same thing. Anyway, I was thinking about that this morning because I'm getting ready to do this other podcast, and it's been set up for a week, and it's an hour, and you know the gentleman that's doing it is a great guy, and he's actually been on this podcast, Richard Hyman, who runs the Future Frogmen, and we did a show not that long ago called Calypso Memories about how he was on the Calypso as a young man, and one particular time, John Denver came on board as he was a friend of Captain Cousteau's, and that's where the song started to be written, the Calypso song. And Richard was on watch a couple nights, and he and John would talk. So it was a really great show, and a lot of people listened and enjoyed it, and that's fine. So he asked me to come on his show, which he does with Future Frogmen, and talk about my work in the environment and stuff I've been doing for a very long time, in particular, as I mentioned, the Earth Matters thing with Bill Curtis. So technology sometimes is not our friend. So the whole concept of the Zoom meeting thing baffles me. Remember there was a time when Skype was the whole drill, now it's Zoom. That Skype's like MySpace. Whatever happened to MySpace instead of Facebook? So Skype is out the window, and now it's a Zoom thing. And he lives in Connecticut somewhere, and you know there's maybe some sketchy wireless signal there, and I am outside of Chicago. You wouldn't think there is, but some days there is. So if that's not intact, we can't do a show. I find that sad. On one, well, all the technology on the planet, and because of a wireless connection that's not happening, this has to be postponed to another time, which is fine. You know, we'll get it done at some point. When I do these shows and you hear guests on, everything runs through my phone, so it's tied right into my recording equipment, and this wasn't that kind of deal. So there's a lot of moving parts, and it didn't work out. I had everything set up to talk with Richard, and we had to bag it and tag it, and we'll do it another time when the technology is friendly. So I was getting ready to kind of put everything away. I'm like, wait a minute. I don't, you know, I'm sitting here. I got the time set aside already and everything's set up. So why don't I just do a little bit of a Wednesday rant? See if I can't jack some shorts up while I'm sitting here. So here's the second disclaimer. Might even be the first. I'm not sure. I was out late last night. That is very rare. Greg Daniels, who I played semi-pro football with back when, like, you know, Eisenhower was president or something, he had a birthday yesterday. And Debbie Daniels, his wife, let me know, and she's also a subscriber, so there's her shout out. She let me know it was Greg's birthday, and it was, you know, so I'm in. I'll come over to the On the Rocks Tavern, located conveniently in Elmwood Park, Illinois. There's their plug. You can go back actually to the second podcast from 3 years ago about Memorial Day, and you should if you haven't, and listen to my conversation with Greg on how that tavern, that saloon, that bar came to be. When his son Nicholas was killed in action in 2011, the death benefit was used, and Nick told him, if anything happens to me, Pop, buy the bar. And he did. But we were there last night, actually almost into this morning. And listen, I will never turn down a nice glass of rye whiskey on ice. That's just the bottom line. My voice is actually a little hoarse from gargling it all night. And so anyway, long story short, it could have been a really long story. We had a great evening last night. It's always great to see them. I wish it was under different circumstances because that kind of loss never goes away. And you have to go through it over and over again at different levels. And that doesn't make it any easier. But that second show I did on Memorial Day, go listen to that when you get time. And his views, as Brian Jopek's views about Memorial Day, that whole thing about Memorial Day being happy is bullshit. And I know we're never going to get people to stop selling mattresses, tires, and other assorted goodies on any holiday they can make cash on. But happy and Memorial Day should not be in the same sentence. And that was what was on my mind last night. So, you know, rewind back to 2018, I guess. Memorial Day of 2018. And might even be 17. Anyway, it's there. It's the second one. Go all the way back to the first page of the Life 2.0 podcast. And at the bottom, the first thing is Rants, Raves, and Reflections as I geared up on this. And then the second one from the bottom is Memorial Day with Greg and put your ear on that. So anyway, I'm not usually out after midnight. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm in bed by, what, 4 in the afternoon most times? But it felt good. It was good to be with friends and hang out. And it's important energy to have in your life, especially in these times. So as I was getting ready to kind of wrap all that up, I thought, well, I'm going to use this space, as I said. And I actually wrote this a week ago. But most of you have never heard it or read it. So I thought, well, I can still use this as the Wednesday rant, and hopefully I can make a point. I always talk about find the obvious buried in the absurdity of life, trying to find sense in the senseless, you know? And when I see how this pandemic is exploding exponentially and people are acting surprised because of human behavior, I'm just sit back and like, this is a movie. You know, 3-4 months ago, they all predicted if we don't do these things, then these things will happen. So we didn't do these things, and now it's happening. And people walk around surprised. And to the point where you have to have people get on and say, well, you know, the president had to come out and say, now it's a patriotic thing to wear your mask. And he puts it on. It took months for that to happen. And I'm not here to talk about the president per se, but I'm talking about how human behavior can make or break things. And to get people, I knew a guy who adamantly said, I'd rather die in a car accident than wear a seatbelt. He didn't want anybody to tell him what to do. That denial DNA is built so deep in us. I think it goes back to splitting from England, right? We're not going to let anybody tell us what to do, even if it's good for us. So anyway, here's my Wednesday rant for you today. The first wave started with the recorded infection in a U.S. Army private stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, back on March 4th, 1918. Although the United States and other nations at war initially suppressed news of the flu, neutral Spain freely reported it, hence the misnomer Spanish flu. But at some point, there was a sense that following these new health precautions wasn't an inconvenience, but should be patriotic. Sound familiar? 1918? Sound familiar? As one Red Cross PSA put it, the man or woman or child who will not wear a mask is now a dangerous slacker. This sense of wartime duty and the fear of being a slacker may have motivated those who finally complied with mask orders in cities like San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, and Phoenix. Yet over time, compliance did become higher. Still, some complained that the masks were uncomfortable, ineffective, or bad for business. Officials were caught in public without masks. And after the war ended, there was no longer a sense that people should wear masks to keep the troops safe. Some dissenters even formed an anti-mask league in San Francisco. Some businesses worried customers would shop less if they had to wear a mask when they went outside, and some people even claim that mask ordinances were an infringement on their civil liberties. Sound familiar, number two? Cities that passed masking ordinances in the fall of 1918 struggled to enforce them among the small portion of people who rebelled. Common punishments back then were fines, prison sentences, and having your name printed in the paper. In one horrific incident in San Francisco, a special officer for the Board of Health shot a man who refused to wear a mask as well as two bystanders. You think this shit's just happening now? This is 1918. Reported cases of the Spanish flu dropped off over the summer of 1918, and there was hope at the beginning of August that the virus had run its course. In retrospect, it was the calm before the storm. Somewhere in Europe, a mutated strain of the Spanish flu virus had emerged that had the power to kill a perfectly healthy young man or woman within 24 hours of showing the first signs of infection. Sound familiar, number three? From September through November of 1918, the death rate from the Spanish flu skyrocketed. In the United States alone, 195,000 Americans died from the Spanish flu in just the month of October of 1918. And unlike a normal seasonal flu, which mostly claims victims among the very young and the very old, the second wave of the so-called Spanish flu exhibited what's called a W curve. High numbers of death among the young and the old, but also a huge spike in the middle composed of otherwise healthy 25 to 35-year-olds in the prime of their life. Sound familiar? Number four. History is a great teacher. Humans, for the most part, aren't very good students, and we often have to repeat the same courses over and over and over and over again, even if it's 102 years later. Eventually, the virus infected 500 million people worldwide and killed an estimated 20 to 50 million people. That's more than all of the soldiers and civilians killed in World War I combined. Here's a fun side note for you. It's unlikely that the Spanish flu actually originated in Spain. Scientists are still not sure of its source. Spain was one of only few major European countries to remain neutral, as I mentioned, in World War I. Unlike in the Allied and Central Powers nations, where wartime censors suppressed news of the flu to avoid affecting morale. However, the Spanish media was free to report it in gory detail, and when the news of the sickness first made headlines in Madrid in late May of 1918, and the coverage only increased after the Spanish King Alfonso XIII came down with a nasty case a week later. Since nations that were undergoing media blackout could only read in-depth accounts from Spanish news sources, of course, they naturally assumed that the country was the pandemic's ground zero. The Spanish, meanwhile, believed the virus had spread to them from France. So they called it the French flu. For a time, hatred of Spain and the United States showed up on many fronts, including possible trade restrictions and anti-Spain rallies held in the streets. By the time the pandemic ran its course, 2 years later, one of the biggest impacts was that the lifespan in America was decreased by 10 years. That's a huge hit on our population. Bottom line, the more things change, the less we do. And so tying technology into that message for me is not much of a stretch. Bucky Fuller, I hear in my head all the time, it's painfully obvious that technology is surpassing our humanity. And so while we have all these neat gadgets and cool things, and our society chugs along, I must see 20 or 30 cell phone commercials a day, you know, when I'm flipping through channels, all getting you to get a next plan or get a free phone. So you have all that stuff that's supposed to bring us together and do things, and it really doesn't. It's just racking billions up for the companies, and that's what they're in business for, and that's fine. But the illusion is that somehow if you have this technology, your life's better. I couldn't even do an interview today. Now, wireless is incredible. I mean, the fact that I can get on my phone and send a text message to one of my kids and they see it, that's still mind-boggling to me. But when it fails, then we're left with each other. And so here we are in the, 102 years after the flu of 1918, and it's the same shit, different year. And that says a lot about how we are lagging behind in who we are or who we could be because of this. I say it all the time. One of my favorite sayings, part of it came from my old buddy Wayne Dyer, who used to say, when you squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice. There's no surprise there. And I think what he was alluding to is, life is predictable when it's predictable, but it can be very unpredictable. And that's where humans come in. So Wayne said, when you squeeze a tomato, you get tomato juice. I added, when you squeeze humans, all kind of shit comes out. And technology squeezes us all the time. A pandemic in the 21st century, with all our military might and all our technology and all our cool cell phones and all the medical knowledge in the world, and you can't get people to wear a goddamn mask. That's human nature. It was the same human nature 102 years ago it is now. So what's that, 4 or 5 generations back, maybe 6? Not much has changed. It's the same balancing act. Find it sadly fascinating on my end. I really do. I was thinking about this earlier today as well, getting ready to do this other show that never actually happened. And if I was on terrestrial radio now doing a, quote, traditional show, I would walk in, I'd be doing a 3-hour live shift, let's say WGN, where I was the last stop I had. And I would have all this information and fodder about what I'd want to talk about. 3 hours live. When you put commercials in and news breaks, you're probably talking about really total time, about 2.5. But it's still a bit of a stretch. When you're talking to a million people for 3 hours, you got to keep their attention. And one of the great ways to do it is get people to have differing opinions. It gets the phones ringing. That's the kind of the background. If you haven't figured that out listening to radio, then you haven't been listening to radio. Nothing is solved there. As much as I enjoy radio, first of all, I don't listen to it anymore. But secondly, in all my years there, there was never a time where I thought, wow, we really just solved something. There was a problem here. We fixed it. That's never happened. What it was raising awareness about problems. They were never fixed in that time frame. I'll never forget. I was on the air at WGN, and this is 6-7 years ago, and there were, like there is now here in Chicago, there was an overabundance of murders in a certain part of the city. And I had Father Michael Flager on, who is from St. Sabina Church, and he's been an advocate, for years about, anti-gun violence, stuff like that. And he is a lightning rod here. Good guy, takes a lot of heat, does a lot of good, and I respect him for. And in that 7 years, it's only gotten worse, hasn't gotten better. So whatever, the old saying, if you want to keep getting what you're getting, keep doing what you're doing, that's true. So there's been no change really in certain areas of any major city where you see this stuff going on as people get squeezed together. And he said something that was really important to me and profound. I've never forgotten it. He said, John, you have to understand that, and you can't understand it because you have not lived this way as these people do that are doing this to each other, that the only way they think they can respond, this is their response to whatever the stimulus is. So some kid grew up in a way and his belief system is that you're supposed to respond with a gun. They don't know that it's wrong or right. They just respond. It's like a knee-jerk reaction. This is how they respond to conflict. You would sit down, talk it out, write it out, do whatever. These kids don't have that. Their conflict resolution is a gun. And when he said that, a little bell went off in the back of my head. But he's right. They have no skills and tools. Put all the other stuff aside. I'm not talking about the environment or the social impact and who the political people are in charge. Forget that. These kids that do this in response to conflict, this is their conflict resolution, is to shoot each other. Maybe somewhere inside of them they know it's wrong, but it's not wrong enough to stop them. And it continues. So generation after generation, it's a conditioned response to a stimulus, right? And I said, well, what if they put conflict resolution counselors in the Chicago schools to work, have a class. And the phone lines lit up. And everybody said I was wrong. And I wanted to know why. Why would it be so bad if you put another level of some sort of opportunity or option for these kids that apparently don't have one in the Chicago public schools? And caller after caller just disagreed with me. That'll never work. That I'm thinking, okay, so what we're doing now or not doing now isn't working anyway. So try this for 60 months and let's see what happens. And it boiled down from it just won't work to you can't expect a teacher to add one more thing to their day. And I never once said that. And so you can see this descending spiral of what should be conversation that can lead to transformation turns into just a tug of war over something that neither one of us can really control, but we have an opinion on. And so after a couple of calls like that, the teachers are, I know, I did some teaching myself at my old alma mater, Shurs High School. I know it's a bit of a war zone. I've been there. I went to school in the city, taught in the city. I spend time in the city, you know, so I get that. I never said that. I said, but what if we had a company, a corporation, somebody who could fund a program that could be held at the school, you know, for 45 minutes or an hour after school's over? The teachers don't do it. It's a private thing. They bring somebody in. Then they jumped on that. Can't privatize the schools. Never said that. So you can see when there's solutions that are being presented, how difficult it is to get people to get on board with anything that might make any sense. That's just on that level. And it's a serious level, as there's murders over the weekend again, the way it's been here in Chicago for years, because we keep doing what we're doing and getting what we're getting. And so the concept for me of some company or a group of corporations putting in, you know, a grand a month or whatever it took to get some conflict resolution services inside the schools where these kids can talk or learn something different was viable to me. I'd even volunteer to help if I could. But I didn't get that response when I was on the radio. And that told me a lot. And it goes right back to what's going on with this pandemic. You know, everybody's got an opinion. But my point in that is, if we can't look back 102 years ago and see that nothing's changed as far as human behavior, that it's basically the same breakdown as it was 102 years ago in 1918, that then they thought it was the Spanish flu, and it probably was or wasn't, who knows. Now we're blaming other countries instead of dealing with the shit that's right in front of us. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. I tell my kids, one of the cardinal rules in life is that it's not what happens to you that matters. It's how you respond that count. You mostly can't control what happens to you for the most part. You just can't. But you have full control and capacity about how you respond to what happens. And so our response as a nation, without pointing fingers at anybody in particular, any group in particular, is sad. The greatest nation on earth. Really? Really? I find that renders me speechless. When I watch all the flag waving and the chest beating as a veteran myself, I love this country. I signed up to defend it. And I find that we fall short when we really need it. It's easy when it's easy. But when it's hard like this, we see who we're not. And that's sometimes more important than seeing who you are. Until next time, safe travels, be well, wear a mask. Adios.